This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. It's just past 6 o'clock on the 6th of September. Brian, has been an exciting 24 hours for you.
Well, it has. Well, the Voyager thing is quite an interesting thing that I'm looking forward to chatting about.
Yeah, so we have a news report that suggests that Voyager 1 and 2, which were launched over 40 years ago, continues to send data back from outer space, and it's relying on technology that was developed in the 1970s.
Yeah, so a lot of it's vacuum tube technology. So this is an era before chips. And it's amazing that they're still able to function because they're very reliable technology. And still send us data. We're still learning. It's fantastic.
Okay. What we're also learning is that Hurricane Irma is strengthening into a Category 5 storm. This is fresh on the heels of Harvey. So it's expected to reach hit the Caribbean as well as reach Florida in the USA. Now, this, of course, goes along with news that we have or information we have that in August itself, 25 times more people died in African states and countries due to, flooding and storms than did in Harvey. And in fact, much of the reports on the devastation focused on Harvey during the month of August with not scant, but little or less coverage of, events of the sort in Nepal, northern Bangladesh and Pakistan.
Yes, and also, Sharad, not forgetting the floods in Bangladesh.
Yeah, also, there was, interestingly, a report of a four-year-old girl who died of cerebral malaria in northern Italy, a region otherwise known to be free of disease. The four-year-old girl hadn't traveled. And so, the question of warming climate and perhaps even the, introduction of mosquitoes into that part of Europe. Very interesting story. Apparently, doctors are mystified. Yeah. Also in the news, yesterday we had reports from the United Nations that refugees crossing into Bangladesh from Myanmar, from the Rohingya community, but not just Rohingyas, we also had Hindus and other communities. Some 35,000 new arrivals in under 24 hours, so huge movements of people. Also, we had a report in the press about the views of a Myanmar general who says that the actions are taken by the security forces is unfinished business from just after World War II.
So these unfinished business, Sharad, this relates to some of the ethnic issues that they've had simmering for the last 60 years.
Yeah, so what? Just very quickly, the Rohingya community supported Britain during World War II against the Japanese. The Japanese were supported by the Rakhine Buddhists in the western part of Burma, what was then known as Burma. Also very quickly on the Korean, tensions on the north, on the Korean Peninsula rather, Putin, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, says sanctions against North Korea are useless. They'd rather eat grass than give up their nuclear program. All that and more we'll be exploring after the 8:30 news. So stay tuned for that. Now we have Atlanta Rhythm section and Spooky, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Spooky by Atlanta Rhythm section. I'm sure I could in with me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run continues. We go, of course, take you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. And remember, you can always join this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or join the conversation via WhatsApp. Our number is 018-789-8899. It is the 6th of September. Spooky, it was probably not the way you might describe what's happened in with the retirement of the Inspector General of Police. He has been made the chairman of Prasarana Berhad, and of course it's the government GLC. And this is quite a kind of practice that's become quite normal. We had Tan Sri Issa Samad from Felda, who was appointed chairman of the Land Public Transport Commission, or SPAD, following his resignation from FGV. And in fact, if you look back at Prasarana before him, The chairman was Tan Sri Ismail Ahmad, Ismail Adam, and he was appointed chairman following his retirement from position of Secretary General of the Public Services Department. So this is a kind of very typical practice, it seems, within government.
Well, yes, it is. And Sharad, it's been going on for a very, very long time. Often it's seen as a reward for all the years of dedicated service to dedicated public service, at often lower compensation perhaps than if they would have got in a corporate sector. So nice little carrot, retirement carrot at the end of it for the next couple of years that they remain productive.
So the question, of course, is is this carrot necessary? Or don't they have a retirement plan? Why is it that they are singled out for these positions? And also, and I think perhaps even more troubling for a lot of thinking Malaysians, the concerned Malaysians, is whether the expectations of a position at a GLC post-retirement stop civil servants from speaking out while they're in service. Does it inhibit them from carrying out their duties to their fullest extent?
I would think, Sharad, one point of view would be that, of course, that's very natural. You want to ensure that you don't rock the boat so that post-retirement, you've got somewhere to go to. So that's a very valid point. On the other hand, also, the other issue is really about competency. Do you, as a police chief, have the competency to run a transportation company or helm a transportation company? That's a bigger issue for shareholders of that business.
Right, so a lot of GLCs, I mean, perhaps different GLCs operate slightly differently in terms of the role of the chairperson or the chairman, whether they have a real executive power, that their leadership is significant to the entity itself, or whether it's largely ceremonial. And if it's ceremonial, what is it cost, or what cost is it to the taxpayer? Because obviously the money spent on these roles could have gone into some other, public service.
And it's also quite significant, Sharad, in terms of money spent on these positions. So you look at the role of a chairman. The chairman is really supposed to direct the board and to provide oversight, particularly for the stuff that the CEO does in terms of running the business. Now, if you don't know enough about the business, how can you question the CEO or see whether or not the business is going in the right direction? Are you? And a lot of times the chairman, for example, acts even as a coach to a CEO. How is an inspector of police, for example, expected to do that?
I mean, I also wonder if perhaps, I'm being somewhat churlish when criticizing or being cynical about these moves, and whether these are positions that are well deserved by the individuals. And not just speaking of, the ex-IGP, Khalid, but in any of these senior civil servants. And also, but on this, by the same token, I think the question of, so many civil servants on the lower ranks who've never earned huge bucks, don't expect any kind of compensation of the sort when they leave the service. I mean, maybe they get a one-off ex gratia payment or sorts. But the expectation that the elite within the civil service have, that government will continue to fund them, post-retirement and for a good part of it, is extraordinary. And, whether this is a really bad practice ultimately.
But, Sharad, it's not a practice that's limited to Malaysia. We don't have to go very far. Just look across to Singapore as well. Civil servants often move on, or ex-generals either become politicians or they become GLC board chairmen or CEOs and so forth.
Yeah,
It's not uncommon in Singapore as well.
Yeah, so there you have, as we in Malaysia, a party that's controlled the state for decades, in fact, since independence. And there's a kind of fusion between party and state and government and these entities that are under government in the state. So it's perhaps a function of our political system that the position of chairperson is a reward for years of service, rather than just being rewarded because through a pension and such. Well, after this we have Ice House and Great Southern Land BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Ice House and Great Southern Land. I'm sure you're cooking with me, Brian Fernandez, who does have a Twitter account. It's at BrianF168. So if you want to communicate and have a conversation with Brian, remember, that's the way to do it. It was at least one way of doing it. It's getting to him through his Twitter handle. You're not much of a Twitter person, are you?
No, I'm not, but I promise will get into
it. Well, no promise. You don't have to make any promises to me, Brian. Why is it that Twitter does not excite you? Do you have other social media platforms that you're much more active on?
Yes, I'm active basically in two platforms, Facebook and LinkedIn as well. So LinkedIn tends to be a very professional, focused engagement. And I add everyone that wants to connect with me. But Facebook tends to be very focused on personal friends and a personal social circle.
Okay, so do you limit who can add you on that one?
On Facebook, yes. Facebook. On LinkedIn, anyone can come and add me.
Okay, it's like a public toilet there on LinkedIn. Now, you know,
well, don't quite put it that way.
So when it comes to all these platforms, because the opportunities to be had with social media platforms, and one of the big things that's been happening is the numbers of enterprises and social causes that go to social media platforms to raise funds.
Yeah, so essentially crowdfunding is not a new thing. It's happened over the last decade. It initially started out really with equity type crowdfunding or project crowdfunding. People are very familiar with things like Kickstarter, for example. So it's related to building a project or if you want to achieve something or raise money for your business. But what's really expanded greatly now is social giving or charity crowdfunding. So you can, if you've got a problem, you could go on some of these sites like in the US or even in Malaysia, and some of the crowdfunding platforms are going to open it up to charity causes, and you can raise money. So for example, if you want to go to school, there's a site called Sekolah Fund in Malaysia, and that site will allow you to raise money to fund your education.
Oh, I see. So it's about you asking for public support for your personal project. What about schools themselves? Are schools going to the public to raise funds?
No, I'm sure that happens on various sites.
Okay, so for me, it's always been charity. It's always about reaching out to others, right? And whatever platforms have been available, the media, whether it's newspapers or, in fact, just walking the streets. I remember as a young child in Singapore, they had a practice of getting, it's called Flag Day or something.
You
have a tin and you go out and you know, I would sometimes go to the docks and, you know, wait for the workers to come out, and they're very generous, and they would drop little coins in my slot, and, you know, you could really fill up a whole can of goodies by the end of the day, and you raise thousands of dollars.
Absolutely. But now this has taken to a multi-billion dollar industry. So what these platforms do is basically they allow you to raise money for your causes and they take a percentage of whatever is raised. So it's a social for-profit.
Is it a big percentage
business.
Generally?
5%.
5%.
Some of these sites.
So it seems fair enough. They create a platform that takes you away from the local. It takes you, maybe national, even beyond it. Because if you kind of pitch it right, you could be funding from all over the world, couldn't you?
Yes. But the thing is this, it really solves the problem. Now, a lot of people live from paycheck to paycheck. So if you've got an unexpected medical emergency, for example, and you need treatment, this is an opportunity to raise money quickly and get that treatment.
What about moral hazards? I mean, let's not talk about moral hazards. What are the dangers that come from this kind of very open platform? In the past, a respected newspaper might be the platform for a charity or an individual reaching out. And you kind of trust that the story is real because the newspaper would have there was some process of due diligence. But what about due diligence when it comes to this kind of crowdfunding?
So with these sort of platforms, unfortunately, because of the sheer scale of it, there isn't a clear due diligence process. So there have been instances, of course, of abuse. So someone who basically says, "Oh, I'm dying of terminal cancer and I need, $100,000 for treatment," raises some money and then goes on a holiday and blows the money on drinking and partying. So that, but we can't detract you know, the minority and the negative aspects of what the minority is from the positive aspects of fundraising for causes like education.
So do you think platforms, I mean, giving them 5%, shouldn't they put in some measures to check abuse?
I'm sure that's there are various elements that they do. But again, 5% of, say, $1,000. So let's say someone wants to raise $1,000. That's $50.
Yeah, but
so
for the platform over maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of different causes, they're raising quite a bit of money.
Correct.
And isn't it possible, for instance, to have some sort of check would include some sort of legal sanctions? If you misrepresent yourself, we will take legal action against you.
Now, here's the thing. This is the power of social media. And you can do that.
Okay. Coming up, Coldplay and Don't Panic at BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Roy Orbison and Candyman, Brian Fernandez and myself, Sharad Kutin, The Morning Run continues. It's coming up to 40 minutes past 6 on the 6th of September. Now, Brian, apparently a significant number of young Chinese with high expectations have become discouraged and have embraced an attitude known on social media as Sang, spelled S-A-N-G, but I don't quite know the Chinese characters,
right?
The term comes from a Chinese character associated with the word funeral and describes a person who feels dispirited. This Sang or Sang culture revels in often ironic defeatism and is fueled by internet celebrities through music and the popularity of certain mobile games and TV shows, which as well as sad-faced emojis and pessimistic slogans. Now, all this would mean nothing if not for the fact that the Chinese government is very worried about it.
Now, well, yeah, it seems to be that I think one of the key things with this, it's not a new phenomenon in terms of societies that are developing. I think that if you go back to Japan and the bubble economy and how the younger generation faced with expectations and the desire to succeed or push to succeed took the other direction and became slackers. In the US, that was the term for that, the slacker generation as well. So this Sang perhaps is something to do with the one-child policy and parents maybe pushing too hard, and then now there's a pushback.
Well, that could be. There's also, I think, in kind of we look at Chinese history, especially towards the end of the 20th century, moments of this as well. If you look at post Tiananmen China, in particular, I remember the movie Beijing Bastards, made in 1993, that looked at the dispirited youth of China. I think following this inability to push through with political reforms in that country. Political reforms, because central to your sense of how much you can contribute to your society, how much value it's placed on you, as opposed to somebody who's a political cadre or member of government, right? So in this movie, you had a lot of young people just kind of milling about, getting drunk, having no sense of purpose. And I wonder if that is something that happens, you know, cyclically. It happens. Every generation will have its moment when it feels defeated by real life, as it were.
And it's also, I think, that's an interesting point, Sharad, because if you go back further into Chinese history, there were also periods in Chinese history where people were consumed by opium smoking, particularly when the foreign invaders were invading China. And there was a sense of hopelessness and you know, sort of a lost generation. And perhaps it's manifesting itself again. But here, perhaps also, Sharad, it's drawn by the fact that, you know, life has become much tougher in China. There's a lot of competition. While there's a lot of opportunities, there are also intensifying competition for jobs. So going to a good university may not be necessarily the meal ticket that
so
you want.
So it's not about it getting tougher. It's just that, you know, things have changed. And in fact, you know,
and expectations have gone up so much.
So qualitatively, you know, things have improved for the Chinese, right? I mean, the Chinese experiment of picking people out of poverty, raising its people out of poverty from the 70s has been an extraordinary development that, in fact, has improved global inequality scores. You know, inequality and poverty levels have dropped dramatically. primarily from the contributions of China. Now, so that doesn't seem to be a problem, but it's also a sense of purpose. A sense of purpose, you could be fabulously rich and have absolutely no sense of purpose. And that is something, that's a void that cannot be filled with more material goods.
And I think that's a very, very pertinent point, Sharad, because, you think of China, and unfortunately, you think of China now as having no religion, but the religion is actually money. So the sense of purpose, maybe among young people, is just not there, and they're grappling to find a solution.
Which is also why perhaps nationalism has filled the void. In recent times we've had the stunning success of Chinese movies with Chinese-style Rambo characters, and this assertion of Chinese might globally beyond its own borders. So maybe if the patriotism, love for the nation, can fill that void in some in some segments of the Chinese population, including the young, who might be, or might not, as the case may be, excited by the possibilities of a China that is strong and holds its head up high in the League of Nations.
But also, Sharad, let's take a step back and ask ourselves, what percentage of these young people, or these, I'll turn them as slackers, are really part of the overall young person population? China is a huge country. So they could be just 1% of the 380 million millennials that are in China today.
What would you tell your daughter if your daughter became somebody gripped with this kind of, affectation of being, blasé and not concerned about the world and cynical? What would you tell her?
Gosh, obviously, unfortunately, I'd just take the normal parent route and be really concerned about it. And you try to do positive affirmation and send the child to camps and
camps, boot camp.
Yeah, that sort of positive, positives is that you need to surround yourself with positive energy. And here, this is all about negative energy.
Okay, coming up after these messages, Moonchild by Rory Gallagher, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Rory Gallagher and Moonchild. Brian Fernandez and myself, Sharad Kutan, it's just past 51 minutes after 6, and it's the 6th of September. Now, PKR Vice President Rafizi Ramli has questioned lawyer Dato Ambiga Srinivasan's neutrality as a civil society leader. This after Dato Ambiga criticised the opposition party for airing its internal squabbles publicly ahead of the 14th general election. Rafizi called Ambiga's remarks unfair, biased and misinformed. He claimed that she was echoing views held by his rivals in PKR, who sought to include PAS in the Pakatan Harapan Pact, despite objections from certain parties. Now, he also said that, and this was what was quoted in the media, that Ambiga has always been against the Pakatan. Now, this, of course, led to a backlash, and including a response from Ambiga saying, well, all this is really a distraction. I'm not going to deal with Rafizi's thing. This was a position put out really in the interest of strengthening the federal opposition, and also raised many questions, especially in social media, about political party leaders on both sides of the aisle and their intolerance of dissent. Well, actually, not just both sides of the aisle, in particular, the federal opposition that claims to be champions of democracy.
Yeah, and that worries me as a voter because, again, This is 2017. You would think that we're coming up to 60 years of independence, that we would have reached a level of political maturity that we would agree to disagree.
Yeah. So Rafizi is saying that he suspects that Ambiga is closer to one faction, perhaps in terms of friendship or associations, and that she was taking sides. And as somebody who is a civil society activist and leader, she should be neutral with regard to party factionalism.
But she doesn't have to be. I mean, she has her views. She's expressing a view. Why should he take it so personally?
Yeah, and also I think what she went on, and in fact, if you look at what she says herself, it's really not about taking sides. It was more like saying, why are you squabbling in public? And I think she expressed perhaps a frustration that a lot of people who are sympathetic even to the federal opposition feel about the way in which politicians on the federal opposition side conduct themselves.
And again, I think he's got a very good point about trying to focus attention really on getting the opposition ready for elections.
That's her, rather.
That's her, yes. And as a voter who believes in having a strong opposition as a counterbalance to the ruling party, they need to get their act together in terms of a federal opposition.
But why do you think that politicians, at least if the claim is correct, are so thin-skinned?
I have no idea. They should be far more mature, as I said, and sophisticated enough to understand that the voter of today wants intelligent discourse. But from the opposition, we also want an element of unity. It was so close to an election, less than a year ago, very likely in terms of timelines, yet they can't even agree on some of their basic tenets in terms of governance moving forward. How are we expected to vote for them?
You know, I think what's interesting that you mentioned there, Brian, about the tone of the conversation, right? You want robust debate. It seems like I think everybody wants that. They want, but they also want it in a way that isn't about tearing people down. So when Rafizi gets reported as saying Ambika was never for the Pakatan, and she, from the start, from the get-go, she was against it, it seemed one of those overblown statements. Now, I don't know if that's what he said, because sometimes is misreporting, but to the extent that he did say that, I mean, if that's true, then the question is, why is this kind of overblown reaction? Why not just say, okay, at some point she took sides and perhaps she's ideologically more in favor of one faction than the other in terms of their strategic thinking? This kind of overblown statement comes from, and I was on Twitter, and you know, I asked this question really, and somebody came back and said paranoia. A lot of political leaders are paranoid, and they always think that others are out, you know, for, and the knives are out for them. They're always looking behind their backs.
So again, back to the question earlier, which I mentioned of political maturity. Have we reached a stage where we're mature enough to take criticism on board and say, okay, that's your view, I understand that, but this is my view.
What about in even offices and in, you know, your workplace? Are we all also equally? We're pointing fingers now at politicians.
Yes.
But are we?
I think we are also guilty at that at some point.
Okay, this is Tom Waits. Hang down your head. BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Brian Fernandez. It's coming up 6 minutes past seven on the 6th of September. This is The Morning Run, taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. Remember, you can always join this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899. Now, earlier, Brian, we were talking about the ex-IGP and the new position he's taken up at Prasarana, as well as a position as a special envoy on counterterrorism. Now, but in many minds of many people, the question is really what the new IGP is going to do. He is Fuzi Harun. The question is whether he will raise the standards of operation of the force. BFM spoke to Dato Akbar Sata, president of Transparency International Malaysia, for his views on what he'd like to see the new Inspector General Police do.
First, I would like to congratulate Datuk Sri Muhammad Fauzi to be appointed as the new IGP. The most important issue here is that we will make sure that the police, you know, are clean and free from corruption, because according to our global corruption parameter 2017 survey, stated that police is viewed as the most corrupted institution in Malaysia. So I think this is very important to look into the area. Number two, to monitor the officer so that they do not misuse the power. Third point will be take care of the welfare of the lower rank and file officer. I mean, so meaning to say that consider to build more quarters for them and also to consider to raise their salary. I think the new IGP have to continue the community policing. Police alone, they cannot fight crime. Like what has been done by UK and US and other developed countries where their community policing are very prominent and well received by the public. So this is very important.
We also asked Akbar what he thinks about the whole issue of corruption and transparency within the force.
To me, it is very important for the police to be transparent. Like, it's no point to hide anything. Like, as long as you are transparent, you conduct your work professionally. And of course, at the moment, they have Jabatan Integriti in the police. So I think the Jabatan is not that effective. If possible, try to make sure that this Jabatan or this department will be more stronger. And if possible, appoint MBCC officer to sit as the chief integrity officer. At least initially you start with this so that we can see that you are really serious in fighting corruption. But if you put your own man, then people will be skeptical and thinking that, you know, there must be something that you want to hide. As a police force, being a professional body, should act independently and make sure that those who are going against the law, even though your own officer, you have to take action. It is wrong, you know, to protect someone.
If you remember, of course, the deputy IGP didn't get the position of IGP. Instead, it went to the head of special branch, where Fuzi comes from. And we asked Akbar whether he thinks this background in the special branch changes perceptions of the man as well as expectations of what he can do.
Yeah, of course, ex-SB chief, because it is vital. But you need also a good administrator, you know, to make sure that the welfare of the police officer has to be taken care. Number two, make sure that there'll be no team, no team A, team B. This is very bad. So make sure that, you know, you bring them together to fight against crime. So if you want PDRM to be respected, make sure that you yourself have to show good example and, of course, try to avoid getting involved in corruption and also with organized criminal and so on. Because these people can not only spoil the image of the organization, the image of PDRM, but also the image of the country. Because these people, once you accept bribe, they can control you. They will monitor you, and of course you have no say. Last but not least, you have to be fair. When they investigate without fear and favor, no matter any political divide, but you have to be fair. Nobody is above the law.
And that was Dato' Akbar Satta, President of Transparency International, speaking about expectations that are being generated around the appointment of the new Inspector General of Police. Brian, because, you know, I don't know if you read this in the papers, but the new IGP does not have a Twitter account or is not active on Twitter, unlike his predecessor. And I'm wondering if this is, in fact, a good thing.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think he's got bigger issues to deal with. The key thing being also corruption within the force, which is just we just talked about. How is that going to be tackled? When is that going to be tackled? Because it's a sense of urgency. There is a sense of urgency, obviously. Corruption is something that has resulted in the lack of trust in the police. You know, there's a trust deficit. How is he going to tackle that?
I mean, these are really major issues, especially when we look at the question of trust. I mean, the long-standing problem for the force, often seen by at least urban folk as being more interested in perhaps squeezing the foreign worker, undocumented worker in the neighbourhood than, in fact, tackling crimes. But we know there's a big debate on it, with Pamandu, I think, putting out the view that statistics for crimes actually have been quite good and suggests a lowering in crime rates, except the perception has not followed with those statistics.
So as an urban person who tries to take a different point of view, so one of the challenges that the police, especially at the lower ranks, face is really the rising cost of living. If you've got 5 children, you're a police officer, you need to feed your family, and you're on 1,000-plus ringgit a month, you've got challenges. So the temptation is therefore to commit and take.
Yeah,
right.
That may be, right? So the interface between the general population or the working population, especially foreign workers with lower-ranking members of the force, are one thing. But many times what we don't get is a sense of how much the higher-ups are involved in corruption, to what extent they've provide protection for criminal activity. And of course, you know, over the last year or so, we've had some high-ranking members of the police force taken in by the MACC, I think with the agreement of the Inspector General of Police, you know, rooting out corruption among the force, because it's really the higher-ups, or at least the middle-ranking guys, who can direct their men to either investigate or not investigate or stay away from certain criminal activities that might be happening in the community.
Especially, and this is also, that's what Dato' Akbar Sata talked about in terms of staying away from organized crime. I think organized crime is a big element, and that's why the sums involved in terms of some of the senior police officers that you mentioned, the sums involved are staggering in terms of...
Yeah, I think also, you know, what I think there's an urgency about, Brian, is the return to the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the police force, the 134 recommendations that were made, what's happened to that? Because, of course, oversight mechanisms were recommended as a way of dealing with many of the problems we've had over the last couple of years. What the former IGP did was he didn't seem open to the idea of reforming the force with oversight from outside the force. I mean, that seems to be a sticking point for the police force. They really want to police their own. They really want to be in control of disciplining their own forces. But, you know, in any modern organization, sometimes you need the external pressure and oversight in order to actually be effective.
I think if you look at how another police force tackled its corruption issue, that's exactly what Hong Kong did. They had external oversight.
We'll be back with more business news, news in general, and analysis. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.